You shouldn't wait until disaster strikes. We should see if we can invest in communities before the disaster strikes to prevent it.
President Obama announces new initiatives to address impacts from climate change. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an Athabascan historian talks about restoring Denali's true name.
The naming something and erasing people's history, I mean, it is really an act of colonialism.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Spinard Builder's Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder's Supply is here to build with you.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Alaskans of all stripes came out this week for a chance to shake hands with President Obama, or at least glimpse his motorcade. But one person was not on hand for the big visit was Don Young, Alaska's only member of the U.S. House of Representatives.
Congressman Young traditionally spends the end of August in his hometown of Fort Yukon, and that's what he did this year.
That's Don Young's spokesman, Matt Shukero. Young is still in Fort Yukon, and his spokesman says not easily reached by phone. But Young did follow what the president said while he was here, and Shukero says he wasn't entirely disappointed.
There were some things that Congressman Young was encouraged to see that was focused on a wider range of Arctic issues, Arctic infrastructure, icebreakers, deep water ports. These are things that Congressman Young and others in the delegation have been fighting for years, and it certainly is important to bring attention to them.
Many Alaskans seemed charmed that the president embraced Alaskan symbols, from sled dog puppies to salmon to native dancing. Young, a Republican in office since Obama was in elementary school, retains his pre-trip skepticism. Shukero says his boss was dismayed that the president used the state as a backdrop for his climate agenda.
The big thing that Congressman Young said was that the president fundamentally just doesn't understand one of Alaska's major, most basic barriers, and that is the federal government and some of its out-of-touch federal policies coming from our agencies.
Alaska's two U.S. senators were taking family time and not available for interviews today. Both of them issued statements thanking President Obama for the Denali name change. Senator Dan Sullivan was the first person to greet the president when he arrived, and he was spotted at the Glacier Conference when Obama spoke. Senator Lisa Murkowski participated in an hour-long meeting with the president, but said she was worried he wasn't hearing enough from Alaskans. President Obama ended his three-day tour of Alaska with a final stop along the western coast in Kotzebue, where he officially unveiled new initiatives aimed at helping Alaska's rural villages cope with climate change in the fast-thawing Arctic. KNOM's Matthew Smith was there.
An Arctic conference in Anchorage, hiking glaciers in Seward, and getting hands-on with salmon in Bristol Bay. All a prelude to President Barack Obama's final stop on his tour of Alaska, which ended in Kotzebue last night. And when the president landed, it was an expected warm welcome.
How are you? Good to see you guys.
As a regional hub for 10 remote villages about 30 miles above the Arctic Circle, Kotzebue is where Obama came closest to actually seeing the communities he's touted throughout his trip as being imperiled by climate change. Communities like Kivalina, whose native village president Millie Hawley says sees those impacts in the environment and their food supply.
We barely got any seal. The bearded seal is what we rely on year-round. Usually we get about 80 in the community per year. This year we got 8. We lost the migration of the beluga, the changes in the migration of the caribou. Even though we try to protect our children from worry or fear, and they sense that things are happening to their home.
The president took to the podium at the Kotzebue Junior and Senior High School to outline plans for a joint tribal, state, and federal effort to help plan and pay for more than 30 communities in rural Alaska looking to relocate or rebuild. Obama calls it climate resilience. The effort will be led by the Denali Commission, an independent federal agency that's worked on Alaska infrastructure projects for nearly 20 years.
And this is going to cut through bureaucracy and red tape, frees up communities like yours to develop and implement solutions for events like coastal erosion and flooding and permafrost degradation.
The commission is also bringing $2 million to the table for relocation efforts. And while relocation is the goal for communities like Kivalina, clean water and functioning sewer systems remain elusive for many rural communities. In his Kotzebue address, the president announced a revision on eligibility within the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Rural Alaska Village Program, opening the doors to more than 30 communities for new water and sewer grants.
You shouldn't wait until disaster strikes. We should see if we can invest in communities before the disaster strikes to prevent it. So today we're announcing more than $17 million in USDA rural water grants for infrastructure projects in remote Alaskan communities.
But is it enough? Northwest Arctic Borough Mayor Reggie Jewell lives in Kotzebue, and as borough mayor, has fewer than 8,000 people living in an area the size of Kentucky. Estimates put the cost of relocating just one village at more than $100 million, with emergency evacuation roads costing as much as $2 million a mile.
None of what we have on the plate, none of what many parts of rural Alaska are asking for, are things on a wish list. There's things that people need.
The president ended his trip with a tour of Kotzebue's Shore Avenue, a reinforced roadway along the coast that local leaders held up as an example of engineering that overcomes climate challenges, something they say Alaska and the Northwest Arctic desperately needs more of. In his speech, Obama echoed that idea that fast action is essential and pledged the federal government's support.
There is such a thing as being too late. The effects can be irreversible if we don't act. And that moment is almost here. And you know this better than anybody. I want you to know, as your president, I'm here to make sure that you get the support that you need.
But before flying out, a final detour, a brief moment with Iditarod musher John Baker. The president donned a Team Baker jacket for a picture with Baker's prize-winning pups, with the commander-in-chief even cradling a blue-eyed puppy named Feather. A quick photo posing behind Baker's dog sled, and then a hop from the motorcade to the airplane, and the president was gone. Like many in Alaska, most in Kotzebue saw President Obama only at arm's length, a handshake or a glimpse as he walked amid a throng of Secret Service, staff, and reporters. But many who came to hear the president speak, or who waved flags and banners as he drove down Shore Avenue, say that they're happy he made Kotzebue his final stop, with the hope that it will cause the conversation about the American Arctic to finally start. Reporting in Kotzebue, I'm Matthew Smith.
Groups working on the relocation of threatened coastal communities in Alaska welcomed the news from the president's speech in Kotzebue yesterday that the Denali Commission will lead the effort.
I think it's a huge step forward for the administration to identify a federal agency as a lead to take on this huge undertaking.
Joel Niemeyer is co-chair of the commission, which was set up almost two decades ago to better funnel federal resources into Alaska programs. At present, the commission does not have the staff to begin systematically working with the dozens of communities recognized as imperiled, but the $2 million set aside by the White House will expand their capacity to review needs.
What we're looking at is vulnerable communities that face environmental threats from flooding, erosion, and permafrost degradation.
The commission will build on policies and procedures that have been implemented by state agencies, maintaining partnerships with both the Army Corps of Engineers and State of Alaska. It's welcome news for those who say the status quo has not been working. Melanie Banke is president of the nonprofit Kwerik, which represents several Bering Strait communities, actively mitigating threats from climate change. She says finding a group to take charge has been a repeated recommendation to the state and federal governments.
We need to coordinate on a state, federal, and local level. Our resources, our energy, there is no one lead agency that is tasked with identifying protective measures that need to be put in place.
Banky says the Denali Commission has been an excellent partner in the past, having financed projects in all 15 communities in the Bering Strait region. Part of the Commission's design for evaluating mitigation and relocation needs is the template established by the Health Facilities Program, which dramatically expanded clinic facilities across rural Alaska. Banky says the high level attention on climate threats to coastal communities is also welcome.
I do think the focus, the level at which the attention is now being commanded from the President of the United States, that is what's new.
Although there is not yet a funding source for actual relocation or mitigation measures, Niemeyer says involvement from the President's recently created Arctic Executive Steering Committee could bring more funds. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the head of the National Endowment for the Arts visits Juneau.
The Alaskan artists have a wonderful way of honoring the long-established traditions of Alaska and at the same time looking forward to the future as well.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
A 58-foot seiner that sank yesterday is now estimated to have spilled 10 to 30 gallons of oil in Sitka waters. The incident took place half a mile from the mouth of Indian River. The Southeast Alaska Petroleum Response Organization, or SEPRO, and local responders deployed booms around the vessel to contain the spill. SEPRO also plans to pre-stage 600 feet of boom in case more oil is released. The owner, William Manos, reports that 600 gallons of diesel fuel and 70 gallons of hydraulic and lube oils were on board the FV Pacific Venture at the time of the sinking. According to the Coast Guard, fuel vents on the port side of the vessel have been plugged and other products remain in closed systems. A dive contractor will assess the situation and potentially remove fuel from the vessel. A unified command includes the Coast Guard, the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, the National Park Service, Sitka Tribe of Alaska, and Manos, the vessel's owner. The Pacific Venture ran aground Tuesday evening, rolled and sank in 25 feet of water on Wednesday morning. No injuries have been reported. The cause of the grounding is currently under investigation. Uber, the taxi-like ride-sharing service, has agreed to pay the state nearly $78,000 because they misclassified drivers as independent contractors instead of employees. The company operated in Anchorage for 6 months, then pulled out in March because Uber could not come to an agreement with the municipality to legally operate in the city. The muni said the company was violating the taxi ordinance. Now the company is also prohibited from operating in the state until they comply with the state's classification laws. According to a statement from the Department of Labor, labeling workers as contractors lets companies avoid paying unemployment insurance, taxes, and workers' compensation premiums. It also violates the Alaska Workers' Compensation Act. The $77,000 will go toward covering uninsured injured workers' claims. Similar lawsuits have been brought against the company throughout the country. The Alaska Forget-Me-Not Coalition met with Matanuska's Susitna-Burrow service providers in Wasilla today to coordinate with organizations that support veterans. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
The outreach event at Wasilla's National Guard Armory is aimed at finding network opportunities with local Matsu community service providers. Lieutenant Colonel Kay Spearbud is the Alaska National Guard Family Program Director. She says the coalition was designed 2 years ago to continue the level of support in communities for veterans and their families.
We started out with behavior health and health, and then we developed from there into separate alliances addressing gaps that have been identified over the last 2 years to include finance, legal, child and youth.
She says Thursday's event in Wasilla drew more than 30 Matsu service organizations. The idea is not to create anything new, Spearbud says,
but build off of what they've already got going, provide military cultural awareness so more people know and understand the military culture, and then make those connections in the community.
The Mat-Su Borough does not provide health or social services to residents. Nonprofits step in as providers of mental health, drug and alcohol abuse counseling, affordable housing, and other needs. Spearbud says there is no one problem that veterans and their families face.
It's unique to every service member and their family and veteran.
The coalition links individual veterans and families with the services appropriate to the family's need, matching the type of coverage, such as Medicaid or Medicare, with the right fit. The coalition also works with providers to arrange sliding scale payments if there is no coverage for services. Spearbud says in Alaska there are 71 to 76,000 veterans, but only about half of them have done the paperwork to claim veteran status.
Here in the Mat-Su Borough, we have approximately 10,000 veterans residing here. That's veterans, not their families. And a good estimate when we figure out families is a 2.5 to every veteran, you know, to average out the family members to go with them.
She says as federal funds dry up, so do services, so it's important to collaborate with providers.
If we can capitalize on that collaboration, then we can carry our money and our services just a little bit further for a little bit longer.
The Alaska National Guard hopes to collaborate with the various agencies to conduct a needs analysis to identify gaps in services or duplication of effort in addressing the needs of veterans and their families. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The leader of the National Endowment for the Arts is in Alaska this week and made a stop at KTOO in Juneau to talk about what she looks for in potential grantees. National Endowment for the Arts Chairman Jane Chu had this to say.
If we can show through hard evidence the connections of arts to our everyday lives, where it might be the beauty of arts itself, or it might be the results of how the arts affect and help academic performance and our students and, achievement as well as healing and other aspects, economic. It's a strong economic driver. So as when we send out and are able to send out the message that the arts belong to all of us, that they're not a frill and they're not off in a corner, but they're really for everybody in all kinds of different ways, that's a measure of success.
Chu also gave her impression of the state's art scene.
The arts community is thriving in Alaska, and one of the things that I've noted the most is they have a wonderful way, the Alaskan artists have a wonderful way of honoring the long-established traditions of Alaska and at the same time looking forward to the future as well.
While in Juneau, Chu met with staff and actors at Perseverance Theater, visited the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, and attended a reception at the Juneau Arts and Cultural Center.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Broken hips and head injuries can have life-altering effects, especially for older adults. But no matter how old you are, it's important to be physically active to prevent injuries. Activity can also increase your strength, balance, and can be done at any age. Ask your healthcare provider about activities that will improve your health. Learn more about starting a new activity at injuryprevention.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Alaskans have been celebrating the federal government's decision to officially recognize Denali as the name of North America's tallest mountain. Aaron Leggett is the Alaska Gallery curator at the Anchorage Museum and an Athabascan historian. He says more than just local Athabascan people had a name for the mountain.
Because it's such a tall mountain, from all, I think, six or seven different Athabascan language vantage points, they can see the mountain, and Denali just happens to be the Koyukon version of it. And they all either translate to the high one, the tall one, or in the case of the Denaina, Deleka'a, big mountain. But nevertheless, they all mean essentially the same thing. It's the mountain, specifically.
What's known about the history of how the name was first given and how that all came about?
Sure. Athabascan people have a special reverence for the mountains. There's a whole there are stories and songs that are only told in the mountains. They're considered to be places of spiritual connection. There's a high language that's only spoken in the mountains. There's a lot of beliefs about proper behavior in the mountains. And that one being the tallest and sort of essentially the most, I guess you could say, sacred, almost never are place names named after people. I would say if you look at Athabaskan naming conventions of places, 99% of them are based more on geographic characteristics or commemorate certain events, but they almost never commemorate people. It's viewed as not a proper thing to do. So to have McKinley's name put on this mountain is sort of all the more ironic.
Aaron, some people say Denali, some people say Denali. Mm-hmm. What's most accurate?
Well, what's most accurate is Denali, is what I was told. So I asked Eliza Jones, who's the preeminent Koyukon linguist, and I said, how would you say it? And Denali is what she said in Koyukon it would actually be. And she'd heard it from another elder who was much older than she was. So Denali would be officially in Koyukon how you would say it.
The name has made Ohio lawmakers really mad. They're all steamed up about it. And some other folks as well, as you said. Donald Trump tweeted that he will change the name back. What do you think about all this outside outrage?
Well, I think a lot. Well, there's two camps on that one. I think from Trump, it's completely partisan politics, that if George W. Bush had done this, there wouldn't have been a peep. This would not have been an issue. But at the end of the day, it should be up to the people of the place to decide if they want to change their own place name. I mean, that, to me, it's just correcting something that should have been fixed 100 years ago. And I've thought a lot about this, and I've thought about places that, the naming something and erasing people's history, I mean, it is really an act of colonialism. And for what's fascinating to me about it is that so many Alaskans can see it from that perspective, not just Athabascans. But there's certainly a lot of work that still needs to be done, I think, with renaming and reclaiming traditional place names. And I've been very fortunate in the work that I do to try to reintroduce traditional place names whenever possible. If we had a time machine and we went back 10 years and I was in the studio here and I was talking to you and I said Tikachnu, you wouldn't know, nobody would know really what I was talking about, but now they'd know, oh, that's a place I can go see the movie, or that's where Target's at. Well, Tikachnu is Big Water River, the Denaina name for Cook Inlet.
Aaron Leggett is the Alaska curator for the Anchorage Museum, a discussion about place names and how Indigenous people are working to revive them will take place at the museum tomorrow at noon. The Juneau Public Library System is collecting Alaska Native stories on educational experiences as part of an oral history project. In this edited interview, Leonora Florendo speaks with her mother, 88-year-old Nora Marks Dauenhauer, who left school in sixth grade but went on to become a prominent Tlingit scholar, poet, and writer. She's published many books with her late husband, Richard Dauenhauer, as well as her own.
Did you go to school in Douglas?
Yes. I went to Douglas School after I was in fourth grade, I think. We got bussed over from Juneau. And I got picked up at the end of the bridge, and we were taken over to Douglas.
And the school is where the Montessori school is now. That was the government school.
These teachers were paranoid. They're afraid that my hair might have bugs. Mm. So they sprayed every one of our hair and clothes with kerosene. And at sixth grade, I dropped out. That was no good for me. You know, it does something for your self-esteem, being a kid and having somebody spare you because you might be full of books, although I didn't have any.
I know that you worked as a fish slimer, as a shrimp picker, a crab shaker, because I've done those.
Chambermaid.
At the Baranoff. Oh, and you did housekeeping for people in the community?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I went from house to house.
You taught at Juneau High School for a while. You were teaching Tlingit.
Yes. There was 14 in my class. Two of them were non-Tlingit. They still come and say hello and we talk.
And they let you go because you weren't certified.
I got halfway through the school teaching, and then I got called by the principal, and he told me that I am no longer going to teach. That was it.
You got your GED before Cy graduated from high school.
I went to GED because working with the high school kids, I discovered that I need help.
And then you went to college?
I majored in anthropology. And some students asked me, what are you going to do with anthropology? Are you going to study yourself? And that's exactly what I did. I worked on my language. People thought of Tlingit as being simple. And your stepdad, Downhour, discovered it's one of the hardest languages he's ever encountered.
Mm-hmm.
Dick and I have numerous books. I haven't counted lately.
That was Nora Marks Downhour speaking with her daughter Lenora Florendo at the Juneau Public Library. Their conversation was recorded as part of the National Oral History Project StoryCorps. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Matthew Smith in Kotzebue, Zachariah Hughes, Ann Hillman, and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Jeremy Shea, Scott Burton, and Lisa Fu in Juneau. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Broken hips and head injuries can have life-altering effects, especially for older adults. But no matter how old you are, it's important to be physically active to prevent injuries. Activity can also increase your strength, balance, and can be done at any age. Ask your healthcare provider about activities that will improve your health. Learn more about starting a new activity at injuryprevention.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.